Okay. Well, now's your chance. Questions? Starting over there, Jenny. Yeah. Switch is just on the base there.
Jenny Rees from Rome Consulting Energy Modelling. We've heard a lot this afternoon about bad types of complementary policies, but it's been emphasised that they can be very important. Can panel members suggest specific policies, complementary policies, that you think would be beneficial or good ones to go for?
Is this on?
Yep.
Okay. I think that's an incredibly good question, and we're working on a report to try and answer that question. One of the things, I think some people look at, say, subsidising wind and say, oh, that was an incredibly bad policy. I actually look at it and I don't think that... I look at what we've done in terms of the last two decades in terms of subsidising wind and see an outcome that... I see lots of good things that have come out of that, not just in Australia but on a global basis. We now have a technology sitting there that at least is going to be a large chunk of the solution, that is going to be a heck of a lot cheaper than what it would have been if we just sat around and twiddled our thumbs and waited till the carbon price pulled it on. And that should hopefully lead to government, one, having... You can look at it as a reconnaissance mission on a low-carbon transformation. By the fact that we're subsidising certain technologies, we get a feel for just what's possible in terms of how hard we can push our policies. So I think some deployment mechanisms can have some kind of positive role to play, but you've got to be quite careful in the way that you do it, such that you avoid a situation of boom-bust. And I think that's the thing that I'm most worried about that I see with some of these policies, is that the level of commitment is tokenistic, and often they'll support it, and then they go, oh, geez, I actually got more than what I wanted. And then we end up with a bust situation where we don't end up with any kind of enduring improvement or change. And I think that's the thing that worries me the most, about certainly the way that people have done it in Australia. But I think there are examples out there where we have seen some material, long-lived improvements in technologies driven by a mixture of deployment and R&D support.
Can I just comment on that? Being based in South Australia, the Premier decided that wind was going to be something he was going to leave behind in appreciation of his tenure there. It has the highest concentration of wind in any state in the world except for Denmark. And as a consequence, as most of you probably realise, wind displaces base load in the system, so it comes into the... is dispatched first. As soon as the temperature reaches 40 degrees in Adelaide, we're dependent upon the Torrens Island plant run by Tim's employer. Tim's not here, he's gone, I can say that. And generally speaking, the price, which would generally be in the region of $30, $20, $30, $40 a megawatt hour, goes to $12,500 a megawatt hour, or a dollar or two short. So there is the potential problem when politicians get hold of these things, and I suppose what I'm just saying is you've got to handle these rationally, rather as what one would call social investments, until they become financially viable for the companies concerned. In AGL's case, it's financially viable because of the gas backup.
Can I just add that, I mean, it's an old saying, to a man with a hammer, the whole world is a nail. I see a lot of people running around who know what the right complementary measures are before they've even asked the question, complementary to what? Right, from my point of view, you can't answer the abstract question, what makes for good complementary policy. You have to look at the design of the price mechanism. You have to look at the design of the renewable energy target. You have to look at the other pieces that are already on the table and then say, given that people are already committed to doing this and this and this, given that, what is the most effective complementary policies I could come up with? And frankly, I don't see a lot of that. I see a lot of people who know that the best complementary policy is a feed-in tariff. It just bloody is, because it works in Germany, Richard. You should see it. It's fantastic. And I say, have they got a renewable energy target? And they say, what's that? So,
given the policy that we have now,
yeah. Look, in the interest of brevity, no. But I'm happy to, truly, I'm happy to have a longer chat with you about it. But really, we have got such a suite of locked-in failure. Like we've done so many crazy things, some good things, and some crazy things.
Okay.
I could give you one example, which was the Energy Efficiency Standards Program. I mean, that is clearly a good program, delivering good outcomes. No one's complained about it. They don't even know it's there. Sometimes they don't know it's there because actually it's not really doing much beyond business as usual. But it is making a material difference. I think we started seeing a reduction in demand, electricity demand over the last 4 years in the residential sector. And that is in no small part due to these programs, but no one's actually complaining about it because they haven't noticed any loss of service as a consequence. We might see some odd complaints about people going, oh, you know, I have to get a compact fluorescent light bulb and I want to get a crappy incandescent. But overall, this is sort of just snuck under the radar screen and no one's noticed it, and they've saved money. So I think that's a clear winner. I think where it gets tough is on the low carbon electricity generation and what's going to work and what's not. And I think in the end, there's plenty of policies out there that have delivered benefits. It's just a matter of could we optimise them some better than what's been done to date. And I don't actually know what the answer is.
Oh, hi, thank you very much. My name is Karen Hassel. I really appreciated that session. I work on mitigation in heavy industry. I'd be really interested in your comments around energy efficiency policy, the role of the Energy Efficiency Opportunities Program, and the mooted National Energy Savings Initiative that's been proposed in the new policy regime, and to what extent they provide valuable complementary or potentially valuable complementary policy measures. And also, you spoke amongst the two of you, you had different perspectives around complementary measures, to what extent they were enabling a more effective implementation of the carbon price, or those that were doing something that couldn't be done through the carbon price. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on industrial energy efficiency from both of those perspectives.
I guess I was trying to say with my left of the curve and right of the curve that, you know, good complementary policies, you know, can be on either side of the curve. You just need to know why you're on that side and what you're trying to do. Just because I maybe haven't upset people enough, I'll have a crack. Once you've got a national cap on emissions, I don't care how much an industrial emitter puts out. I don't care from an environmental point of view whether or not Orica figures out a way to reduce energy use or a cement kiln figures out a way to reduce energy use any more than I care whether they figure out how to lower their phone bills. It's not my problem. The whole point of an emissions trading scheme is we pick a cap of how much pollution we think is acceptable, and then the private sector goes and spends money either abating or paying the price. And I just think that it sort of... And, you know, I can see where people are going to argue with me and say, oh, but we've got to help them discover, blah, blah, blah. It's like, fine, but there's no actual environmental benefit, none, in helping an industrial polluter reduce their emissions. There's a financial benefit to them, but there's a financial benefit to them in, you know, not spending so much money on photocopy toner. And I don't care about that. So once you've got...
What about the idea of politicians set caps with a view to cost, right? So in the end, they decided on $23. What informed that? They could have been 25, could have been 20, you know, could have been 15. But they sure as hell knew that they weren't willing to do 30, and or 35 or 40. But if we can sit there and actually lower the cost of a cap, then we might see politicians modify the environmental ambition that they're willing to do. Or if we had a scheme with a price floor that was relatively high, but a cap that was more stringent, we might end up with a situation where we hit the floor through this, such that lowering cost may equate to more abatement.
Look, I think that's true, but again, I mean, you know, you got to. If I was running the world, no chance of that, so relax. We would have started with a carbon tax, a proper one, because the problem we've done with emissions trading, we'll go back a step, from an economic point of view, you're supposed to pick your emission reduction target based on your social goal. You pick the Q and then you let the market set the P. The problem is we actually picked our Q based on what P we thought was politically acceptable, right? We said, what price do you think people are willing to pay? Therefore, what quantity do you think we can get away with? Which is asked backwards. It's, you know, you should go for a carbon tax if you want to pick a price. But my point is, what we should have done first, and I don't even know if there's a literature on this, maybe there is, we should have done quantity discovery first, right? We're just getting bluffed by polluters about what their response to any given carbon price will be. And we've got no idea. So we've picked a P based on what they've told us about their elasticity of demand for energy. So for the non-economists, apologies, but what I'm saying is, We have no idea what the industrial response will look like. A lot of industrial users have no idea what their response will look like. We should just pick a price and watch what the response looks like for a few years.
Haven't they done that to some extent? Like, I mean, they've gone 3-year fixed price, yeah, and you've got a climate change commission that can sit there and make recommendations. So, mate, it's not all bad.
No,
you know?
That was me.
Okay.
That's the good bit.
So in some respects, maybe we've got that. Yeah, maybe industrial energy efficiency might mean you do get a better environmental outcome because of the climate change.
But that's my point. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm just happy to see what the $23 does before I want to start spending $100 million helping people to cope. I want to see what the market can do with the price first. That's the only bit of the structure I like.
I mean, one thing on the industrial energy efficiency that we actually had looked at and we left out of the final report was we asked a number of people about, have you actually seen, and these were generally people that were providers of energy efficiency products and services, and we said to them, did you see any change in demand for your products and services or inquiry interest, all those sorts of things, as a direct result of the Victorian mandatory energy efficiency requirements, so the mandatory audit and implementation with a 3-year payback, I think it was 3-year payback, with the New South Wales energy savings plans and with EEO. And the unanimous answer was the New South Wales energy savings plan was a complete waste of time. We saw no real change. It was a tick-the-box exercise. Where people just said, yeah, whatever. Vic EPA, a bit better, but basically industry can game the 3-year payback. They'll just say, oh, actually, there's going to be a bit of production downtime for a week as a result of implementing XYZ change. Bang, they can instantly get it out of the 3-year payback, and it just got gamed. And so coming up with mandatory implementation doesn't necessarily fix things. With EEO, the key thing, the feedback we got was that, one, there was substantial government assistance and support that came with the program. Two, the way that they designed it effectively forced people to put in place good management or improved management practices, and it was possible to audit and find that people were not genuinely putting in effort, and that it was leading to improved outcomes. But I suppose my concern is that any kind of voluntary initiative that is sort of information highlighting, I think, can serve a purpose, and there's clearly some reasons for why industry maybe would suboptimise with energy efficiency. But me personally, I think the people that we most need to worry about with energy efficiency are the people for whom energy is a very small component of their budget, and therefore they just don't even worry about it. And that's primarily commercial and residential. And programs should focus on them as a first call on the energy efficiency side. And the carbon price should be largely what Dennis said, you know, let that rip before we start maybe giving financial assistance to industry to improve their energy efficiency, because we just don't know what they're holding in their back pocket, and they may not know yet either.
I should just mention that the National Energy Efficiency Schemes, our team went to a workshop last Monday, and looking at sort of the international evidence from UK, France, Italy, and many of the US states. And alas, the evidence that is clear that they're resulting in emission reductions, but the evidence on the cost efficiency aspects of it is still to be determined. And this is a topic that seems going to be doing further research on in the future, and as well as looking at our current state schemes. So, yeah, it's a topic of ongoing research at our centre.
Hi, this is Veronica Namesh from Victorian Treasury and Finance. I guess for the energy efficiency, it looks really good in your graph, Tristan, but I don't know whether that includes all the money that was spent by government employees or driving that program, because I don't think it would actually...
I'll cover that off. That costs three-fifths of stuff all. The amount of government budget money that goes to that energy efficiency standard program is like a poofteen.
But I think then it becomes really difficult to actually measure how much carbon emissions you actually really achieved, given also that you have made through energy efficiency, the per unit cost of electricity now is cheaper for these companies or firms, and therefore you don't know the rebound effect and all that, which comes actually what I was trying to point out.
There's been a lot of empirical analysis on rebound effect as well. And again, if you're talking about that, you've got to distinguish between a rebound effect from a macroeconomic perspective versus a rebound effect from I've saved money on my refrigerator energy bill, so therefore I'm going to spend more money on energy, or am I just going to save that money? I'll spend it on you know, potato chips or something else. But sorry, the question. Sorry, I interrupted.
No, I was just, I guess, just coming back to the point that the way I see that energy efficiency is that it's basically a transfer from government to the businesses. It's that financial transfer that Richard pointed out. That it's not necessarily a cost savings. It's that. The input into doing that, the companies could have actually done that, but they sat back and they decided not to do it. Then the government kind of came along and helped them to do those energy efficiency measures. And basically the government spent the money instead of the firms. So in that
those programs don't involve any government money. The energy efficiency standards involve... if there is an additional cost, it's borne by the purchaser of the equipment. So an energy efficiency standard is a regulatory standard that says that a building or a refrigerator or a light bulb must meet a minimum level of energy efficiency. And theoretically, that is supposed to mean that refrigerator costs more money for the consumer, or that light bulb costs more for the consumer. There's no money. I'm not talking about the VEET scheme, for example, the Victorian Energy Efficiency Target or rebates. I'm talking about regulatory standards was what was on the bottom of the graph. And that doesn't involve any government transfer of money to industry.
Just in terms of the time spent on that program, I guess, but that's fine. Yeah. The other point that I was going to make is, I guess, there's an argument that we don't actually know how much this abatement is, and I think the only thing that could have revealed that is if the permits were auctioned, and then we could have seen some kind of revelation of that cost. And in absence of that, we can kind of shoot in the dark with tax and try to find that kind of price that will be acceptable. But I think one of the foregone opportunities with doing auctioning of permits and going with an ETS scheme is actually to get a sense of feel for those abatement costs.
Yeah.
Are you talking about an energy efficiency trading scheme, or are you talking about a carbon price?
No, carbon, like a permit trading scheme.
Oh, right. Yeah, I agree with
you. If those permits were auctioned, then I think we could have seen some bids that would have revealed abatement costs.
We'll get some revelation of abatement costs. I suppose it'll only be the marginal, the market clearing marginal cost, I suppose. But you get that in an auction. I suppose in an auction, yeah, if you've got a certain sort of upward ascending auction, you might get some kind of indicator, I suppose, yeah. So, you might get some kind of price discovery there. But I think that's a good point.
Hi, Kate Lee from United Voice. We're a trade union that represents low-income workers. So I've got a kind of an observation. I'm not sure if there's a question at the end of it aimed at Richard and Tristan. So, Richard, you've outlined a, you know, fairly strong reason why none of us perhaps should support complementary measures, or at least certainly ones that don't work. But I guess my thought is that, everyone, I guess, to the left of Tony Abbott, has fully backed a carbon price over the last, number of years at least, in this incarnation of an emissions trading scheme this time round. Certainly from everyone in the environment movement, the trade union movement, the social welfare movement, academics, think tanks. But yet it seems to me that, for a number of years now, there's been a lot of signals from people that are strong market adherents that that a carbon price and so-called complementary measures don't actually mix. And I think that's evident in the draft white paper, where there's, very strong criticism of anything that could be considered a complementary measure. In fact, they're referred to as non-complementary measures. So, it forces everybody then to defend the small scraps of complementary measures that are available, and perhaps you might argue that they should be defending them because they're indefensible. But so it puts people in a pretty difficult position now, I would think. And I guess the RET is a case in point. I mean, Tristan, you've said that that rates on your scale as being remarkably good value for money, and yet for a long time now we've heard particularly state energy regulators say nothing but negative things about the RET. So to me that shows that people that are very strong market adherents, people that don't support Paul's rationales for additional climate policy instruments, aren't necessarily going to listen to what works and what doesn't work. So I've got that as a question, I guess, if you've got any reflections on that. And Richard, for those of us who actually support complementary policies, ones at work, did we do the wrong thing in backing the carbon price?
Look, it's hard. Let me... The renewable energy target stuff, you've got to understand what the renewable energy target does is drive the kind of transformation I was talking about. So the reason I think it's good policy, I'm sure the reason Tristan thinks it's good policy, is that per unit of transformation, it's quite cheap and effective. The reason the energy industry hates it and the energy users hate it is it's dearer. Least cost abatement is buying offsets. Transformation is building shiny things. The renewable energy target is well-designed policy to build shiny things. But by definition, therefore, the people that want least cost abatement don't like things like the renewable energy target. Look, we're in this invidious position now. About complementary policies generally because of the design of the scheme that's passed. And, I can't make life easy for anyone. More than most people, God, I'm talking about myself a lot today, I was screaming at people for the last 3 years saying, please don't let's get put in the position where we have to force to be choosing between do I like a carbon price or do I like complementary policy. I basically spent 2009 and 2010 talking to anyone who'd listen, say, we never want to get to this point where you have it's all price or it's all complementary. We need both, hence the best of both worlds paper that we wrote. So the problem is, well-designed emissions trading scheme could have taken account of complementary policies. You could have had additionality for complementary schemes. I call it cap and slice rather than cap and trade. Well-designed, we could have had it. And, you know, to some small extent, it made it into the final version of the legislation through green power. Right? If you buy green power, it'll always be additional to the national target. But all the other fun stuff that people like isn't. And frankly, it's not there because people didn't fight for it for the last couple of years. Green power got in because the green power industry fought for it. You know, but the green groups didn't fight to get all their lovely, shiny stuff made additional. You know, so my point is, we're in the position now that I have to diagnose so many policies as ineffective because of the design of policy that, frankly, a lot of people sat back and didn't pay attention to, even though I think it was pretty predictable and could have been changed. So, what I'm trying to say to people now, unfortunately, is if we cover it up and pretend it hasn't happened, then we won't fix it in 2020. You know, so we have to play the cards we've been dealt, but every now and then we get the opportunity to shape the cards we're dealt. And maybe next time, if we're honest with people about what complementary policies don't work, we'll do it better. But just a quick list. I mean, if we'd have spent half the money we spent on insulation building high stock public housing that was more energy efficient, that would have been great. Instead, public housing was one of the few things that wasn't eligible for the rebates under the insulation scheme. You know, so I think low-income people have been dudded by feed-in tariffs and been dudded by rebates for people that can afford to access them. You know, and yeah, if you ask me, do I like Tony Abbott's direct action scheme more or less than the carbon price? Well, his stinks to high heaven, but they're not. You know, that's not much of a menu to choose from. We could have chosen from better policy that would have helped low-income earners a lot more and would have actually delivered far more abatement, I think.
It's been a while since you asked the question. I know it was sort of a statement rather than a question. So I'm sort of struggling. I mean, I'll answer your issue there. The people that, if you go and look at what was really happening is the people who are fighting against the RET were fighting against the carbon price too, right? So the bottom fundamental underpinning all of this is they just don't want to pay more tax, right? They just don't, and they look at a RET. You know what a RET is? It's a tax. I have to pay some more money. Whether I have to transfer, whether I pay it direct to the government or I transfer it to someone else, it's a tax. And those same people were saying, don't do an emissions trading scheme. And then they got to a point where the state governments were going to impose an emissions trading scheme. And it was only then when they said, we want an emissions trading scheme. Oh, and by the way, we're willing to accept emissions trading scheme if you get rid of all this other stuff that we have to pay for. Even though now they get an exemption certificate for the renewable energy target anyway, so they don't actually pay very much for their renewable energy target, right? In fact, a number of the energy consumers are benefiting through lower energy bills through the renewable energy target. In fact, the renewable energy target is subsidising large energy consumers, and they haven't even realised it yet because it's lowering the wholesale pool price. And they're not paying for it. Householders are paying for it, which is something that many people don't realise. South Australia's wholesale pool price has been materially lowered as a consequence of the renewable energy target. There's been a bunch of work done by Beyond Zero Emissions around solar PV, which indicates that it's a gigawatt of solar, if it was all in the one spot, I suppose, within a state, would probably lop a fair bit off the peak. That's just pure. It's not about logic there. I mean, it is about logic. It's about I just don't want to pay more money than I have to. I mean, that's fundamentally what that is about. It's not about I don't like complementary measures because I like a carbon tax. So I just don't want to pay more tax, full stop. Within some areas of the bureaucracy, I think you're spot on because they look at the renewable energy target and they go, I don't get it. That looks like a carbon trading scheme to me. They just didn't go all the way. So for them, they don't look at the renewable energy target as an energy transformation measure. They look at that as an abatement measure that had the right idea but didn't quite get it right. And so it's a bit of an abomination, or it just sort of rankles them a bit. Now, you could argue that maybe the RET's not the best way to do energy transformation and all those sorts of things, but that I think that's the two different camps and the way they look at it. With our analysis, make no mistake, there are cheaper ways to reduce emissions than a renewable energy target. And we did not say that you should deliver your 2020 target through a renewable energy target. What we said is a renewable energy target was quite a good measure in terms of delivering volume at a reasonable price, but you could get more volume cheaper through a more broad-based measure than a renewable energy target.
Okay. We've run over time and there's more questions and we're just not going to be able to get to them. I did just want to give Paul and Tony, if you just want to make any last sort of comments or takeaways from this, brief ones.
Just briefly, in the last question, I think one of the requirements for complementary measures arose because as soon as the scheme, albeit carbon price or emissions trading scheme, is introduced, then there's always the fair play, who wants to be an exemption, and everybody wants to be an exemption. So they introduce further market distortions, which basically the complementary measures come in to offset. So if you didn't have the distortions in the first place by allowing, and a good example would be the power generators, who want exemptions in the Latrobe Valley. So in come the complementary measures, we'll shut down some of you, we'll pay you for closure. And so suddenly the South Australian brown coal producers also want to be compensated and they want to shut down. The result of that is at the moment the Northern Power Station's chucking out 1.7 tonnes of carbon per megawatt hour just to convince the government it's one of the dirtiest in the country.
I think it's just a crap power station.
Yeah, and the dirtiest in the country.
I don't think they did it deliberately to do that.
Paul, any final comments?
Three themes that were picked up today, and I just want to mention, I think, a part of our ongoing research, it seems, and if it is of interest to you as well, and you've got ideas, come and speak to us later about it. And they were coherence. Richard and I pointed out the fossil fuel perverseness of the subsidies going on there, but there's other aspects of coherence in climate policy that we should be thinking further about. Interaction, again, Richard and I both mentioned this interaction between intrinsic and extrinsic motivations, and particularly through the CAP. But there are other aspects of climate policy interactions that I think there's further research should be done on. And robustness, as Tristan was saying, prediction is difficult. And one of our interests at the moment is how can we design climate policy to be more robust in the face of uncertainty or deep uncertainty. And that's an ongoing interest of ours. And I was pleased that these themes were picked up today.